That's the job of the pessimist, to constantly push the optimist to move forward and say, okay, you know, you need to think about more and more ways in which things can move. But I think the important part that we need to make sure that we do not forget in our progress towards this is that we are taking into account the perspectives of all constituents. Because in any change, transformation, there are the left behinds, and then there are the people who get the advantage of the change. Now, if the left behinds are a large number, the momentum could have a problem. And I think I would rather the change be robust rather than be quick.
Welcome back to the Decarb Connect podcast. I'm really pleased this week to be joined by Jaya Sundy, who is the Executive Director of CSTEP, which is the Centre for the Study of Science, Technology and Policy. And he is going to give us, it'll have to be something of an overview, but an overview of India and some of the work being done to develop the baseline for policies that are going to be needed in future, both to decarbonize industry in India, but also to create some opportunities. But it's not just that I'm pleased to have Jay on. I'm pleased that we're able to look in some detail, as much as you can, in a podcast format at India, because actually as a company, Decarb Connect is increasingly getting outreach from steel, from cement and other kind of manufacturers in that region. And it's just, yeah, I'm really excited to learn a little bit more about the landscape there. So Jay, you're very welcome. Thank you for agreeing to join us.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me. And I will try my best to provide a perspective.
Well, let's start with my standard question. And anybody that listens to this knows that I self-describe this as the lazy podcaster's question, because it's a way of getting you to introduce yourself. So I'm going to ask you just to give a bit of a feel for your personal and professional journey into this point in time where you're working in this policy landscape. So tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Thank you, Alex, once again. And I grew up in the city of Bombay. I would say a fairly privileged upbringing. My father was a scientist, and he inculcated this notion of inquiry in my life right in an early age. And when I did get to college, I took up chemical engineering as a discipline. And I think one of my earliest trysts with the idea of policy and public life came through when I was studying in my final year on the issue of water supply for chemical industrial outfits. And that's when I saw not just effluent treatment, but also the idea of using reverse osmosis for water supply for companies. And that's when I started to realize the enormity of what we are getting into as we increase our production and the need for water. Water was a very important issue. And that's when I really made a left turn in some ways, where I said that I should focus more on technology and policy rather than just technology alone. Fast forward a few years, I was doing my PhD at the Department of Engineering and Public Policy at Carnegie Mellon. And one of the things that I was working on there was not so much on anything to do with climate or energy, but more on issues around information systems and how information systems are used in various environments. I went on to teach at the University of Texas at Dallas. And after a short stint there, I moved back to India and joined the organization I am with right now, which is the Center for Study of Science, Technology and Policy. And the explicit purpose of the organization is to enrich policy making with the use of innovative methods in science and technology for a sustainable, secure, inclusive society. So in summary, we work on problems related to clean energy, looking at clean air, looking at issues around sustainable development or circular economy, or looking at climate change and climate adaptation over the long term. And at the underlying of all of this is this idea of using digital technologies and digital tools that will help with these decisions. So one of the things that I like to think about in what I like in my journey has been this idea of being all over the place, but at the same time being in certain places at the right time. So my background in chemical engineering and background in some of the hard disciplines has helped me understand some of the constraints or constants related to engineering, both electrical, chemical, mechanical. And then also my background in information systems is helping me understand decision support systems and how decision makers make decisions and how they are going about making their decisions and how to help them with their decision. As a think tank, we think of ourselves not as an entity that gives you the answer, but gives you the means to come to an answer.
And just for a little more context on C-STEP itself, is it funded by a foundation? Is it funded by consulting work? What's the kind of the basis for how the group operates?
Right. So C-STEP as an organization is a not-for-profit research company as far as the Indian acts are concerned. So most of our funding, or in fact, all of our funding comes through philanthropic support. We are one of the few institutions that do not have a large endowment to speak of. And we are pretty much driven by writing proposals for grants from philanthropic organizations. We have raised almost around, I would say about $50 million over the last 15 years, with money coming from almost 65 organizations. So no single organization has given any amount that has ever been larger than 15% of our budgets at any given point in time.
That's great. I think that's really helpful just to have that sense of the neutrality that you bring to this. And of course, being a nonprofit just means your lens on it is able to be a little different too. So you've given us that feel that your work and your focus is on how policy gets to be designed. And also I know from our prep call that it's also about this idea of how to motivate the right activity, motivate the right decisions. And obviously our interest is specifically around decarb and climate. I know that C-STEP does focus on other aspects as well, but can you give a feel for, just again, a final bit of context here. What sorts of outcomes or activities has the approach that you take generated before? And then what's the goal with decarbonisation? How do you think you can apply that in that space? And then we'll dig a bit more into India more generally.
So we have worked in various areas around energy and climate. One of the things that we are pursuing right now is this perspective that we can make impact at five different levels. The first level being where we write publications or write papers that will be cited by peers or used by peers in their work that they are doing on some of these areas. The next level would be when government entities take a look at the reports that we produce and make that part of policy or make that part of what is going on. We have done that in a number of occasions. But the more interesting ones for us now are the ones where we get to the next levels, which is either creation of pilots based on an idea that we have come about, or more so also a large-scale implementation of a particular idea in a particular state or in the entire country as a whole. So this is the sort of the what we would call the four steps of impact. The ultimate impact, though, would be our ability to connect what work we have done to actual changes on the ground, be it in clean energy, be it in clean air, or be it in issues related to climate. And these could take a lot much longer period of time, of course, because we are looking at issues around scale. Some examples of the work that we have done that have actually made impact is in the early days, we did work on how information technology can be used in the power sector. And that became led to some policies that led to more use of information technology in the power distribution as well as the transmission sector. More recently, we have been working in various states on air quality and looking at how air quality can be improved. And those have now made it into their respective clean air action plans for those states. We have also worked with certain states on their their climate action plans, which is more to do with what do they need to do in terms of mitigation, which is about the clean energy transition, and what do they need to do in terms of adaptation, which is largely around how do they deal with higher temperatures, greater or lower rainfall, and what it will mean for the agroeconomy or the economy as a whole for that particular state in India. So these are sort of examples that we have been working with. We are constantly looking at how can we think about our ideas to be adopted at scale and how they can be used in a much wider context as much as possible.
Great. Really, really helpful summary just to understand what you're bringing to the table and the kind of the nature of the work. So let's dive on in as much as we can, as I said at the beginning in one podcast episode, into a sort of an overview of some of the commitments and thought processes that are going into policy creation in India. Perhaps you could kick off, actually, obviously our audience is international. Could you give a very brief summary on what's the balance of power or the balance of policymaking between state and federal government in India? And then could you tell us a little about those two main commitments that India has already made, as well as, again, just our starting point?
So as many who are aware of India will know that we have a fairly federal structure when it comes to most decision making. There are certain subjects that are supposed to be state subjects, which means the local governments will decide on them, while there are some subjects that are national subjects, which are what the federal government decides. Of course, the earth doesn't care for these boundaries that human beings create. And so from that perspective, it is not a diktat that one state or one or the central government can put on each other. But at the same time, there's a division of labor of some sorts. So in some ways, issues around climate, when it comes to national commitments, these are done at the central level. Of course, there's no way that the central government can achieve these targets if the states don't play along. I think in my opinion, the watershed moment was the Paris COP, where the Indian government actually changed or, almost doubled down on its stance of saying that we will commit to a clean or green energy future. And at that time, there were these commitments that were made on emissions related to GDP, which is called emissions intensity. And then there was also some commitments on renewable energy. And there was also commitments on carbon sequestration. But the most significant commitment that was made by the central government was in the recent COP, where there was a commitment to net zero by 2070. And that 50% of the electricity capacity in India would come from renewable energy sources by 2030. So there's a short-term goal and there's a long-term goal. As you will realize that these goals are, according to some, very ambitious, according to some, very much doable. But at the same time, what we do realize is that it's the center and the states that have to work in tandem for this to happen. And for that purpose, obviously, there are central government schemes that have come about to encourage each of these in their targets. And at the same time, you have not just the states coming up with ideas on how they would achieve net zero at a much earlier date, but also what they will need to do in order to reach the renewable energy capacity target. So in some ways, it is sort of a dance of some sorts. You cannot have two people going in two completely opposite directions, but you have to work in tandem to be able to make it look good and achieve the results that you would want to get. So I think in that sense, there is this, while there is a bit of tension in terms of how we will go about achieving it, I think the North Star or the goal, final goal of where to reach is pretty much shared between the states and the center. I don't think, or I have not seen any place where there is a massive difference in opinion when it comes to the goals. It may just be about how much they will achieve and how much time in that regard.
So we have these two, let's take those two more recent goals that you've described. So net zero emissions by 2070 and this 50% marker for electricity from renewable by 2030, which is obviously the more pressing one in a way, I suppose, like how you get that infrastructure in place. So when you look at that, when your team are looking at that, what do you see as some of the practical implications? And also, what are you seeing in terms of actual kind of policy, either discussion or policy that's, kind of making its way through government that is actually going to feed into that at this stage. I know it's in the time span of climate, it's not that long since the last COP. So obviously we're not going to have a final bill of law on the table, I guess, around these things. But what's, yeah, practical sorry, excuse me, practical implications, and then that kind of what's happening to actually develop the supporting policy.
So I will address this particular question at two completely different levels. First, let me give you the holistic perspective or the large perspective, right? So one is that, yes, we have announced this net zero target by 2070. And one of the things that is very clear, and I think I would also encourage your listeners to look up the report that we put out a couple of years ago now, almost a year ago now, called No Silver Bullet. It's basically essays on India's net zero transition. And I will be referring to a lot of that thinking because it continues to remain our thinking in what I say now. One is, long-term transitions are incredibly complex. For the very fact that how many of us would imagine what we would be doing with our time in the year 2000, which is less than 25 years ago. Right. It's a point in time that many of the people who are above the age of 40 would have been adults in the year 2000. And I don't think they would have imagined that they would be able to call a taxi with a device sitting in their hand or be able to translate a lot of things going on simultaneously or even speak to somebody from across the other side of the globe over a video connection. Right. That time, a voice connection itself was a great deal. Now we are taking it completely for granted and we only think about video and we've just not gotten into 3D because I don't think people are comfortable with that yet. But that said, we have to keep in mind that when we think about long-term futures like 2060, 2070, we are making a lot of assumptions in what we think is going to be the future. Right. And this is particularly true when we as modelers or we as researchers look at some of these things. And I think we have to keep in mind that what may seem not optimal today could likely be the most likely scenario 40 years from now or 30 years from now. So that is one thing. The second thing is we have to keep thinking about different scenarios. And that's the way we should be thinking about it. And that said, one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that we have been making assumptions about demand of our societies that may seem very unrealistic today because of the fact that we are not being very realistic about what demand will be in the future. One great example is due to really good energy efficiency measures using LED light bulbs, the amount of energy consumed for lighting has actually gone down over periods of time rather than gone up. And that is quite a big thing. So that said, I think one is the idea of how do you estimate demand? And I think one of the indicators for us is this idea of using what we would call a decent quality of life for all. And I think the government, the Indian government has also now called it lifestyle for environment, which is a way of thinking about the future, the way of thinking about how we will think about demand in the future, right? Do we all need to be living in concrete steel houses, or can we have local materials like stone and other local materials to be used for our houses? So that will drive the next thing, which is about industrial decarbonization. When we think about industrial decarbonization, it also is pivoted on the idea of what the demand is going to be and how is that demand going to be shaped over periods of time. Now, that said, it's not that there's not going to be growth, but there will be growth in particular areas, particular problems, and there's an immense opportunity there. There's an immense opportunity in terms of coming up with new ideas, maybe new materials, new sources of energy also, or new ways in which we can think about reducing the carbon footprint, either in terms of reduced emission or absorbing it back into a process that uses that carbon in one way or the other. So in some ways, there is this idea about, we also have, you have the demand, you have the supply, and I think it's a simultaneous equation game that we will have to play in order for us to be able to achieve that net zero over a long period of time. Innovation will be an important part of that, but it will also mean that we will need to be innovative in the way we govern ourselves, manage ourselves, and even incentivize some of these innovations.
It's, I think, a really interesting point that, you know, when we talk in the UK, when people talk in the US about how do we get, you know, what is it that we need to do to reduce CO2? What is consumer demand going to be shaped around? We obviously talk a lot about, well, we're going to need to persuade people to either do less city breaks or fly different places or upgrade to an electric car, or the kind of the things we focus on are obviously very different than you would focus on across such a broad and sizable population in India. So it's kind of interesting to me to understand that when you think about the sheer number of people who live at the breadline, or certainly at a kind of, you know, the living off the land, like there's clearly a sense that a proportion of them would want to be lifted out of that into, you know, working middle class or whatever the right structure names are. And of course, that brings with it a CO2 footprint. So when you're talking about this idea of the lifestyle for environment, is that really what the government is talking about when they use that phrase? That is it to do with this shift in how parts of the population live, or does it mean something else?
It is, from what I've understood, it is largely about keeping in mind the environment when you are thinking about a lifestyle, right? So you don't go around cutting down a forest because you wanted to build a house in a particular place, but think about how exactly can you minimize your footprint so that you minimize your footprint on the environment. Now, I think that's where, the early development used to always be about per capita income or certain amount of energy being consumed by households or individuals. And I think the aspect that we are exploring through our decent quality of life framing is to saying what amount of energy or what amount of materials would one need if one were to think about a decent quality of life for all individuals. So that is people who are, let's say, below the poverty line, or what we would call people in abject poverty, how do we get them up? But it doesn't mean that they are going to all live like an average American, but they could be living a decent quality of life, which gives them shelter, gives them food, adequate food, gives them education, gives them healthcare, gives them an opportunity for a living, and also gives them this a notion of a decent, what we would call a decent life.
I just want to take this opportunity to thank our production partner and sponsor, Jano Media, for their support in delivering the Decarb Connect podcast. Over the last few years, they've helped us to facilitate great conversations that connect us with our audience. And their skills and expertise mean that we get to concentrate exclusively on generating the content, the conversations that engage, inform, and inspire. So obviously, with that idea of lifting more, as many as possible people into this decent life, this ability to live differently, less personal and family risk, more opportunity. That brings with it a lot of demands for types of technologies and materials. What's this? I mean, I'm not even sure how to phrase this question really, but what do you see as the demand on tech and materials as we develop society? And does that feel deliverable? And does it feel deliverable within the context of these climate goals that have been set?
So, yeah, so, you know, so this is something that you can definitely look at. We've got a couple of reports on some of these things, looking at how demand is actually going to increase over a period of time. And then, of course, it saturates at some point in time, simply because also that the Indian population is also expected to peak by, somewhere mid-century, right? So there is going to be an increase in demand for various things, right? From food, cement, steel, all the commodities that we think about required for development. And then it will, of course, peak at some point in time, and then maybe even fall a little bit because of either efficiencies or even in terms of the population is going to peak. So the population is also going to start falling, and so on and so forth. So those are, I think, the ways we have thought about it in terms of how much of various materials would we need for people to have this decent quality of life. And you know, obviously we have to take the bare minimum to saying, okay, what's the bare minimum that people will need in order to do that, which means that the actual amount will be a little higher. It's just that a great fraction of the people will be, you know, not in abject poverty, but at least in above this, what we would call a decent quality of life metric.
So in terms of, I mean, if we're, I guess the kind of key materials, if we think of it in that way, steel, perhaps, cement, perhaps, is there a feel for, you know, how in percentage terms that material demand is going to grow? Or is that still something that sort of people are getting their hands around?
So you know, you're right, absolutely. So cement, steel, aluminium, various materials, in fact, even food grains, all will have to grow. And the growth rates are such that they are likely to even maybe even double or treble over the next 20 to 30 years, right? So because there is such latent demand, given that there is not enough housing for all, there's not enough infrastructure, there's a huge amount of infrastructure that we will need to build and create to even get to what we would call a decent quality of life. So there is a range, and you know, it's not one number, but it is expected to grow quite significantly, which is why you have these prognostications of the Indian economy growing at a particular rate for the next decade or two. And that is primarily because you are going to see this doubling or even trebling over the next 20 years, which is around the what I would call the 6 to 7%. So when you have a 7% growth rate, it's going to double every 10 years. So 20 years would mean quadrupling. So we are looking at somewhere between 6 to 7%. So it comes to around that number.
And in energy terms, I mean, obviously, as consumers step up and have a different style of life and expectations, there's an increasing demand for electricity. Obviously, in the UK, we tend to obsess over heating. In India, it's more cooling. But again, with that sort of trying to give a number and a feel for the, you know, the growth of energy consumption in mind, what's your sense of that? Like, what's the energy requirement going to be just from the consumer market, let alone, you know, the industrials meeting this additional demand?
So it's interesting. So there are the energy power, there are these estimates that come out every year, the Central Electricity Authority puts out. And these EPS estimates have always been very optimistic. So there is this sense that, say, by 2030, there is an estimate that our total capacity for electricity is going to be around 500 gigawatts, but there is a sense that it might only be 450 gigawatts, largely due to energy efficiency measures, ways in which you figure out how to produce certain things without needing that kind of electricity. And so as a result, each and every state that we are looking at also starts to estimate how much energy it's going to plan for in the coming decade. And majority of the energy is used by the industrial power sector. And then, of course, you did talk about cooling. Cooling definitely is going to become a burden. But the thought process right now is that can we think of alternate ways to cooling, providing thermal comfort, as we call it, without the expensive HVAC systems? Can we think about ways in which passive cooling can be adopted and that could actually end up saving energy yet providing the necessary thermal comfort? It's not that everyone needs to be in a 20 degree centigrade environment. Many people are comfortable at 26, 27, 28 degrees centigrade, and that's all you really need to get to. You don't need to go from 40 degrees or 45 degrees where it is in many places down all the way to 18 or 20. You can be at 26, 27, 28, and by and large, people will be comfortable at those temperatures. So from our perspective, there are opportunities there to shape the demand in a way that could make it more feasible to provide that level of thermal comfort for all.
Great. So now we've got this context for this growing economy, this massive, huge population, a country that's kind of this shifting upwards in lifestyle and expectation of how people can and should live, a doubling or a trebling of some of the most critical materials that are part of that, incredible growth, which can be managed in some ways, but in kind of electricity consumption. And at the same time, a government that has made these commitments to different types of deadlines and timelines. So if I'm an investor looking at that, I'm thinking, well, this is a market that as it grows is going to want to buy different technologies. It's going to want to buy different types of materials and products. So that's an interesting opportunity. If I'm an industrial looking at that, I'm thinking, that's great. There's a huge opportunity. But how on earth are we going to do this complex and challenging and expensive work if there's no support? So how does a country like India balance that opportunity, like the opportunity to facilitate, kickstart, invest in, develop technologies that could be exported, but also incentivize, support, drive the kind of essential in-country decarbonization? So those two, I mean, I know there's probably many more types of policy than that, but if we look at them bluntly in the kind of how do we set policy to go after the opportunity, how do we set policy to go after the essential in-country change as well and manage that, push that behavior? What are you seeing emerging or what are you hearing as the kind of policy mechanisms that seem to be getting some interest? So one more kind of addition to the question is I know that CBAM has already changed some of the conversations in India about what types of policy could come in first. So that's kind of interesting as well. But what do you see starting to take shape and what do you hear in terms of policy design creation?
Yeah, so I think in the initial stages, there was a lot of talk about, one, the commitments. And the commitments required a lot of work from internal folks. But once we got to and I meant the commitments of Paris COP, right? Which was more about renewable energy, about energy efficiency of intensity of the economy. All those were internal. But once we got to 2070 net zero, that is a much bigger challenge. So one is you have policies on investments for a clean energy transition in the short term. There's going to be policies for transition in the medium to long term, which will also require a large amount of R&D, because we need to still figure out what those technologies of the future are going to be. I don't think we have, like I said in the beginning, I don't think we have the answers to what's going to happen or what we're going to be doing in 2050 today. 25 years is indeed a long period of time. That said, there are policies for R&D. There are policies now which are called product-linked incentives, or sorry, production-linked incentives, which are more about how much of something renewable are you producing, and you will get paid based on how much you produce. So as a result, the current environment is actually quite fertile for two kinds of things. One is for people who have decarbonization technologies or technologies that are already proven to come in and start to implement them in places. So that example is already being shown with the solar industry, the wind industry. And these are some of the places where people are already, huge amounts of investments have been going in, and that has got a life of its own. The second piece is where you have these ideas where it could be a fairly risky venture. And there's an opportunity, though, that if you manage to try it out in India and become successful at that, then suddenly you have an opportunity to use that learning and implement it somewhere else in the world. And that is another opportunity that the government seems to be moving towards, is allowing for pilots, allowing for new technologies to be experimented. And the advantage to the diversity that India is that you can choose the location to apply it based on where you feel you'd want to sell it later on too. So if you try it in all states in India, you pretty much have covered most of the world, because every state in India is like a different country. And your learnings, your experience, and what you're doing, not just climatic conditions, but other issues also, you will learn a lot in the process, and hence can be taken to different geographies. And in some cases, it could also mean better application in places like Europe, United States, Australia, any places, not to mention, of course, the obvious places like Latin America and Africa, where there's a huge opportunity for leapfrogging, and can be done through once you've had the opportunity to test it out in India, where not only there is availability of human capital to help you with that, but in some cases, there's also quite a bit of financial capital available because of the maturity of the economy, maturity of the ecosystem to handle large capital inflows and essentially a largely rule-based environment.
So when you look at the landscape right now, again, coming back to that question of what do you hear being whispered about as potential policy directions? As I mentioned, there has been this sense that CBAM has perhaps sped up or maybe changed the quality of some of the conversations around carbon market pricing and creation. What do you see coming? And if you're a betting man, what would you be putting money on as being some of the early policy levers that will really come into action?
So I think the renewable energy focus right now is a very big one, simply because that has gone beyond the policy, the policy stage, and has got to the stage of what I would call, almost implementation. You're getting into the idea of where investment and activity is starting to happen. And there's a huge amount going on there. And I think that opportunity continues to exist, given the fact that the target is almost 250 gigawatts. Let's assume the 500 gigawatt target. So 250 gigawatts of renewable energy to come up by 2030, which is the next 6 years, or should we say five and a half almost, is a very short period of time, and a huge opportunity there for people who want to work in that space, renewable energy generation production. And there has been a move towards decentralized energy generation and production also. So as a result, there are opportunities for many players to come in and play their role in different places. So just because one entity has come in doesn't mean that there is no room for anyone else, given that there are 30 odd states in India where we can actually go and explore various forms of renewable energy in that space. So that is definitely one place. The second one, as you mentioned about CBAM, the industry, in my view, is a largely export-oriented industry. So as a result, they are already selling to Europe. So they are seeing the headwinds. They are seeing what's going on and what they will need to change in order to achieve those net zero targets, because they will need to show not only their investors, but also to their customers that they are indeed towing the line. And as a result, there's a huge opportunity. In fact, it may be even faster for entities to work with the industrial entities in India. And the advantage that I see is that there are a lot of funds that are also coming into India that are trying to invest in issues around green energy and climate. And they see this simply because there's an opportunity for new ideas, new technologies, new perspectives to proliferate into the market. And I don't think anybody can today say that they know what the future is going to look like, because nobody does. There are various opportunities in generation, in storage, which is a very big area because of the intermittency of renewables. Huge, huge opportunity there. Then there are opportunities in the space of consumption, various forms of consumption, be it in transport. There are people doing electric vehicles. Again, that's a huge opportunity. There's also opportunities in industry, looking at better materials for various kinds of things. So there are a lot of areas. Each of them have different timelines. And like I mentioned, the production-linked incentive schemes help towards those.
It could be a pretty brief yes or no answer, to be honest. But when you look at the Inflation Reduction Act and all of the discussion about the enormous amounts of incentives that are on the table, and some of the mechanisms, you know, for example, building up that tax equity incentive and things like that, do you get the feel that India would pursue not necessarily that level of investment, but something similar, or do you think it will be a totally different path?
I think in India, the sense I get personally is that investments are going to be where the benefits are going to reach a large number of people. So I think the recent announcement of the rooftop solar program by the government, it's called the Prime Minister's Rooftop Solar Program, where they are going to be putting about 60,000 crores into that program to incentivize rooftop solar. The idea was to go to 10 million households. It was not to create one or two mega facilities, but to see if 10 million households can benefit from that. And I think my sense, that is where I get it from this, is that how do we make sure that majority of people get the benefit of any program that is being proposed by the government?
That's a really interesting lens. I hadn't really thought about that in terms of the IRA before, about what is, you know, it's pulling a massive lever in maybe five or six places. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but versus, as you're saying, that kind of more even spread of the benefit of that kind of government programming. Okay. One of the interesting things that, as I think I mentioned at the start of this podcast, is that we at DCOP have been seeing this outreach from steel, from cement in particular, and from some of the value chain, the kind of more smaller national businesses that are also supporting those massive conglomerates. It interests me a lot that in India, it certainly feels to us in the team that there is almost more of a push from industry than some of the other constituents around the table. I don't know if that's just, you know, everyone comes at this from their own lens. Like, I'm interested in whether, like, do you think that is the case? Does it feel like there are some different movers and shakers in India around decarbonization?
In India, the sense I get, of course, is that I think all industry have become more conscious of the fact that, one, climate change is real, and that it will take just a disaster or two for people to suddenly say that, look here, we are not going to consume anything which has got a very high carbon footprint. And that's a genuine risk, right? And I think companies are starting to think about it a lot more carefully, because they do perceive it as a risk, because the flight of a customer is the worst thing any company would like. And I think that is the thing that is keeping them probably awake at night, thinking about how are they going to adjust to this new future? And what do they need to know and do today so that they can mitigate that risk? So that's the sense that I get from this.
Okay. So you have talked already about India as somewhere that has this huge opportunity. You know, the demand for different types of materials, different levels of electricity, different sources of energy is going to rise. When you think about that kind of opportunity that both external and domestic companies and investors could be taking advantage of versus the current pace of development of policy and I guess the kind of associated deployments, what's your assessment of, obviously this is massive change in any country that we're trying to engineer. Do you think, is the pace the right pace at the moment, or are there things that could be done to kind of, I don't know, engineer a quicker transition? What is your perception of the landscape tell you about that?
So the optimist in me will say that the pace of change is good. The pessimist in me will say that the pace of change is not so good. And I think it's a matter of perspective, right? This is the glass half full, half empty. Are there things that can be done? Absolutely. Are there things happening faster than we expected? Absolutely. So I think, you know, these are complex systems. It's hard for us to say that this is how things will work, because I think to a large extent, we operate in a very linear fashion. It's a very linear outlook that we have. And I think we just need to, you know, keep thinking about it. And I think that's the job of the pessimist, to constantly push the optimist to move forward and say, okay, you know, you need to think about more and more ways in which things can move. But I think the important part that we need to make sure that we do not forget in our progress towards this is that we are taking into account the perspectives of all constituents. Because in any change, transformation, there are the left behinds, and then there are the people who get the advantage of the change. Now, if the left behinds are a large number, the momentum could have a problem. And I think I would rather the change be robust rather than be quick.
Okay, well, one more question for you, Jay, and then I will release you to your real world job rather than just my podcast. But you've already talked a little, I was about to ask what will be unique about India's challenge, but you've already highlighted some of it, which is the emphasis on renewables is obviously a different opportunity for India than some of the other countries around the world. When you think about energy transition and industrial decarb, what else do you feel is going to be either pursued differently, or, you know, is there going to be a different emphasis on certain technologies? What else would you highlight as unique to India?
Yeah, I think the unique challenge of the energy transition to India is really going to be the global context, which is we have always been talking about energy, increasing in energy to improve GDP, to improve human development indices, right? Now, there is a large fraction of India that's still, you know, what we would call below the poverty line or barely subsistence level of living. And that is a cause for concern, right? So if you want to think about it from that perspective, that is unique, right? Because you need to also provide these people energy so that they can live a better life. But you cannot tell them that, no, you can't have the energy because we have these global commitments. So there are these challenges that are very unique to India. That is, we are yet to develop. There are parts of the country that are developed. And there is this huge disparity. One is, how do we move forward in this new era of climate change while keeping a certain level of development across the country and bringing up people the only models we have been the ones about burning more fossil fuels and getting there. It's not been about what are alternate ways to think about development, or how do we think about development in a renewable energy future. Not everything is about energy too. In some cases, it is about creating the systems that allow humans to help each other. If you look at healthcare, there are opportunities there that are not solely around how much fuel you burn, but it's also about how you build capacity and resilience in local communities to deal with extreme events that when they come or that become more often. And so I think enabling communities will be that interesting way of thinking about making sure that people have a good, again, quality of life.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for spending the time. I think, as we both knew going into this, trying to encapsulate a country the size of India and its ambitions and requirements for decarbonisation in one podcast episode is obviously challenging. But I think you've done a fantastic job at laying out both what is unique, what is already happening, but also what the opportunities are. And I think those opportunities, as you described them, make it a very interesting landscape, both domestic industrials, companies, investors, as well as those international. So thank you for laying that out for us.
Thank you, Alex. Again, I think these were very deep questions, which I can assure your listeners are not easy to answer and not easy to get right either. So it's going to be something that we are, and as a think tank, that is something that we are very keen on, is to continue to have conversations around these, because our models, our work are not expected to be forecasts, but more an ability for us to explore the future in ways that we can think today are possible. There are going to be known unknowns, which we try to explore, but then there are going to be unknown unknowns, which could become game changers in a matter of a decade. And I think that could make changes quite significant going forward. I just wanted to say that, India provides that opportunity for many people working in the climate area, simply because it also has the capacity. It has a lot of young people who are willing to work in these particular areas. And as the awareness of climate change and the needs of the future become more evident, more and more people will start working in these areas, and you will get to see more ideas coming out of this space. So thank you again for this opportunity, and I look forward to interacting with your listeners and other people that come across this podcast.
At Jano Media, we recognize that great content has the power to create impactful and positive change for lives and society. Whether that's video, live streams, photography, or podcasts, partnering with us will enable you to harness the power of content to engage, inform, and inspire. Reach out to us today.